a rabbi, a Roman Catholic priest, and a Methodist minister are having a discussion. And the discussion is, what's your worst sin? Worst ever sin? And the rabbi says, well, you know, I actually have a real penchant for pork. And last week I went to the greasy spoon and I had a bacon and sausage and black pudding breakfast bap. I'm deeply ashamed. And the Roman Catholic priest said, that's nothing. And the night before I got ordained, I went out to a bar, found a woman. Don't need to tell you the rest. He turned to the Methodist minister. He's not an Anglican, by the way. He's Methodist. And they look at him and says, well, I'm a gossip and I think I'm just about to do my worst sinning. We're looking at thankfulness. There's a point to that joke. We're looking at thankfulness at the moment. David kind of began our series last week when he opened up the first few verses of Psalm 107. And what we're going to do for the next few weeks is take those chunks of Psalm 107. If you look in the Bible, you'll see it's kind of broken into bits. And we're going to be looking at the things that we are thankful for. And today we are going to be looking at what it means to be thankful for freedom and what real freedom is. If you didn't hear David's sermon last week, then get hold of the copy. There's a recording on the website. It's a really good start. We look at Psalm 107. We're in page 610. The Bibles that are in the pews, you might want to just open that. We're going to have a look at that. Have a look at the John passage. Look at something else as well. We might even appear up on screen if Mike helps me. Fingers crossed. We look at Psalm 107 at verse 10. Some sat in darkness and the deepest gloom, prisoners suffering in iron chains. There it is on screen. Prisoners suffering in iron chains. And what are the prisoners of? I think it's sin. It's sin. And that's what Jesus is certainly saying in the reading that Martin read. And that's what we're going to have a look at first. So, as it were, keep your finger in Psalm 107, but turn to the second reading that we had, which was from John chapter 8. That's on page 1074 of the Bibles. It'll also hopefully be up on screen. Mike can help us to do that. Now, this passage from verses 31 to 36 is part of a longer passage in John. Which begins around the start of chapter 8. We have a nice academic debate as to where exactly it starts. And it's all culminating towards John chapter 8, verse 58, where Jesus says, before Abraham was, I am. Before Abraham was, I am. And the Jews pick up stones at that point to stone him, not because he's got bad English grammar, but because by saying I am, he's proclaiming himself to be God. And the whole of John chapter 8 is stacking up where Jesus is basically saying, look at me, work out who I am, work out who I am. So let's begin looking at this bit in John chapter 8, page 1074, it'll be on screen as well, hopefully. John chapter 8, verse 31. To the Jews who had believed him, Jesus said, if you hold to my teaching, you are really my disciples. Now, this is interesting. Because in John's Gospel especially, Jesus brings up this idea of holding to what he says as being the key to being somebody who follows him. Later on, he will say, if you love me, you will obey my commandments. So what Jesus is saying here is this. Following me is not just a question of ticking a few boxes. Son of God, tick. Died for my sins, tick. Rose to life again on the third day, tick. It's not about just getting those intellectual things right. It's about realizing what Jesus is saying that we must do in response to that. How does it affect us? And it's really interesting that actually in John's gospel, compared to the other gospels, a lot of what Jesus talks about is himself and what he will do. A lot of the teaching in Matthew's gospel, so for example, the sermon on the Mount is about what we should do, how we should live. But John's gospel is almost, you know, it's about who am I, Jesus, who am I, and what can I do? That's the teaching he wants us to get in and to follow. He wanted the Jews, he wants us today to do that. So let's move on and see what he's saying to us in particular, what he's saying to you in this passage. Then you will know the truth, and the truth will set you free. You will not know the truth, and you will be able to answer a question and answer session as you stand at the gates of heaven, as Saint Peter kind of checks if you're coming in. It's not about that. The truth about who Jesus is will change you. It will set you free. It will release you from bondage. It is not something that you know, that is something that you are looking forward to when you die. It is something that is going to change you right now. It will set you free. What is this that will set you free? The Jews think that they know. They answered in verse 33, "We are Abraham's descendants and have never been slaves of anyone. How can you say we shall be set free?" We are Abraham's descendants and have never been slaves of anyone. Now that's a curious thing to say. Because firstly, I think they're kidding themselves, aren't they? We have never been slaves of anyone. Have they not read Exodus? Did they miss out the back end of 2 Kings and 2 Chronicles? Were they not looking at the coins that they just paid for their morning bread with the head of a pagan emperor who basically was in charge of their country? They're kidding themselves. We're not slaves to anybody. Absolutely wrong. You are. You've belonged at times, and you belong right now to somebody else. And it's the same sometimes with us. You know, we hear talk of being slaves to sin, slaves of righteousness, and we hear talk of how sin binds us, and we go, "It's not us. It's not me. Sin hasn't got me. I'm not caught. I'm not trapped." We deceive ourselves. We fool ourselves, because actually, if we are brutally honest, we can think of things, of sins that are binding us even right now. Patterns of behavior, things we do, the way that we act, our responses, they catch us. Paul says in Romans, "Why is it that all the things I want to do, I don't do, and the things that I want to do, I never end up doing?" If St. Paul is realistic about how actually we are bound by sin, then we should be true too. But the Jews have an answer. At least these Jews here do. "We are Abraham's descendants." Little footnote in your Bible says seed. We are Abraham's seed, literally. How can we be slaves to sin? Because we are God's people. Because mummy's grandmother's grandmother was Sarah, who was Abraham's wife. Therefore, we are the descendants of Abraham. Therefore, we are God's chosen people. How can we be slaves? How can we be slaves? How can we be in bondage to sin? Of course, Jesus' answer is very clear in verse 34. "I tell you the truth, everyone who sins is a slave to sin. It does not matter who your mummy is, or her mummy, or her mummy. If you sin, you are a slave to sin. You cannot get away from it just because you are Jewish. You cannot get away from it just because you are middle class. You cannot get away from it just because you are English or Greek or Austrian or whatever. Everyone who sins is a slave to sin. We are all slaves to sin. And we need to stop kidding ourselves, and we need to stop pretending that actually sin does not capture us, does not bind us, does not hold us captive, and we need to be honest and truthful. This is what Jesus is talking about. You see, a slave isn't part of the family. That's what Jesus says in verse 35. Now, a slave has no permanent place in the family, but a son belongs to it forever. You know, in those days, you would be the head of a fairly wealthy household. You would have your immediate family, your extended family. You would have servants and slaves. They would all be part of your household. And in some sense, the slave thinks, well, you know, I've got a fairly good master and I'm okay. But when the master dies, will the slave inherit? No. The son inherits. Now, obviously, this is slightly patriarchal society. These days, if we just left our estate to our firstborn son, we'd slightly hack off the rest of the family. But you see the point. It's exactly the point that Paul picks up later on in Romans, where he says, when we become Christians, we become adopted by God. We become sons. We become sons of God. The sons get the inheritance. Think back to Abraham and the promise made to him and Sarah. Promise to Abraham is, your descendants will be like the stars in the sky, like the sand on the beach. And Abraham and Sarah are not having a baby, so Abraham thinks, Hank, right, I'll fix it. I will have a baby with the slave woman, Hagar. And so Ishmael is born. Is Ishmael the descendant? Does the promise come through Ishmael? No. Because what Jesus says is very clear. The son, a slave has no permanent place in the family, but a son belongs to it forever. It's almost as though Ishmael and Isaac, who comes eventually, are this object lesson to us. Slaves do not inherit. Sons do. However well-intentioned the slave is, she is not going to get what comes from the father. So what is the solution? What is the solution? Well, it's very simple. Verse 36. If the Son sets you free, you will be free indeed. If you don't want to be a slave to sin, let the Son set you free. Let the Son set you free from the bondage that you are in. Now, I want us to get a picture of this bondage of sin, because it comes in many ways. I'm going to do a slight diversion. We're going to turn right back to the start of the Bible, to Genesis chapter 3. I know we didn't have it read, but I'm sure we are familiar with it. We go right back, because we need to understand the form that bondage takes on us in order to be released from it, okay? So I'm going to start reading. The really important verses are 6 and 7, but we'll start from Genesis chapter 3, on page 5. Now the serpent was more crafty than any of the wild animals the Lord God had made. He said to the woman, "Did God really say you must not eat from any tree in the garden?" The woman said to the serpent, "We may eat fruit from the trees in the garden, but God did say you must not eat fruit from the tree that is in the middle of the garden, and you must not touch it or you will die." "You will not surely die," the serpent said to the woman. "For God knows that when you eat of it, your eyes will be opened and you will be like God, knowing good and evil." Here we come, the two important verses. "When the woman saw that the fruit of the tree was good for food and pleasing to the eye and also desirable for gaining wisdom, she took some and ate it. She also gave some to her husband who was with her, and he ate it. And then the eyes of both of them were opened, and they realized that they were naked." Now, I could spend hours on this, but we haven't got hours. If you read it again, look at what Eve says, look at what the serpent says. See how the deception begins almost with the first words. That what Eve is saying is not true. That what the serpent is saying is not true. And what happens in the story is very clear. The serpent deceives Eve. The serpent says to Eve, that which you think it is not so. This thing which you've been told is bad is not good. So look at verse 6. Having been deceived, Eve looks at the tree, looks at the fruit, and it's described in three ways. It is good for food, yum yum. It is pleasing to the eye, looks great. It is a peach above all peaches. And it is desirable for gaining wisdom. If I eat this, I will improve myself. It will be good for me. She's completely forgetting what God said back in chapter 2, verse 17. You must not eat from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, for when you eat of it, you will surely die. She's blinkered. She's got these three things she can see. It's fantastic. But the serpent has deceived her, so she does not realize the reality of what she is about to do. That's why in 1 Peter 3, Peter says it was Eve that was deceived, not Adam. And before you think that makes men better, wait for the back end of verse 6 because it's even worse. But for Eve, she is deceived and she takes the fruit thinking this is only going to be good, and she forgets, she's deceived about the things that are bad about it, and she eats it and she sins. And that's us sometimes, isn't it? We look at something and we are deceived as to what the consequence of our actions are. And we think this is going to be great, and in fact, we fall into sin. We fall into sin and we are caught and we are trapped and we are in bondage. And it wasn't that we wanted to be there, we were deceived. We were victims of the world, of the fallen world. But Adam is even worse. Look at this. Back end of verse 6. She also gave some to her husband who was with her, and he ate it. So, Eve, serpent, Eve, chat, tree, fruit, eat. Okay? Eve and the serpent are having the conversation. Adam's, it's not quite clear from the Hebrew, and we can have arguments. Grab Richard afterwards. We can have an argument over. Is Eve's husband right with her, or does he just turn up halfway through the time? But the thing is this, right? He's there as she eats the fruit. Is he having a conversation with the serpent? No. Has he been deceived by the serpent? No. Does he know where the fruit is from? Oh, yes. Does he take it and eat it? Oh, yes. Because there are some times when we know exactly what we are doing and we do it anyway. Do you see the two types of sin there? Sometimes we don't actually understand what we are doing. Sometimes, let's be honest, we know exactly what we are doing. We are choosing to sin. And we become trapped in bondage to it. So let's move to Psalm 107. Because either way, what the Bible tells us is that whether we chose utterly willfully, or whether we were deceived by the world and we were kind of victims, we still sin, we're still responsible for it, and we still pay the price for it. So what does Psalm 107 tell us about what to do about the situation? Because right now, if you're like me, I'm thinking of some kind of sin I'm in bondage to right now. Because this is what God does. As we talk about it in truth, he comes and talks to us. He comes and tells us. He's laying it on the heart. So if you're sat there thinking, actually, yes, I'm in bondage. I can see this. How do I get out of it? Psalm 107, beginning at verse 10. Sun sat in darkness and the deepest gloom, prisoners suffering in iron chains. For they had rebelled against the words of God and despised the counsel of the Most High. So he subjected them to bitter labor. They stumbled and there was no one to help. Now that verse 12 is picking up. If you go home and read Genesis 3, it's picking up the curse, isn't it? In Genesis 3, of what happens. You will toil now for your food. You'll be cast out of my presence. There is no one there. It will be hard work. This is the consequence of sin. We are in bondage. Life is hard. We feel as though God is not there. And what is the solution? What is God's solution? Is it pull yourself up by your bootstraps? No. Is it make sure that you have a Jewish mother? No. Is it buy the curate a Mercedes-Benz on top of your pledge form? No, sorry. It's very simple. Verse 13. Then they cried to the Lord in their trouble, and he saved them from their distress. That's God's plan. That's God's answer. Help. I need somebody. Help. Not just anybody. Help. You know, I need somebody who you, God. That's God's answer. You see, God is in the business of setting us free from sin. And he's in the business of doing it right now. Right now. This is not something I tick the boxes, tick Jesus, Son of God, tick crucifixion, tick resurrection, tick, and wait until I get to heaven for everything to sort itself out. What God says is, I want to sort things out right now. Where you are in bondage to sin, let me free it right now. And how does he do that? He does it by us being truthful. He does it by us letting him show us what the circumstances are, what the truth are, bringing it to him, laying it at the cross, and letting him deal with it. So we come to God and we say, I have sinned. This is what's going on. Making no excuses, no explanations, saying it as it is. And you know what? When we do that, it is transformational. It is healing. Let me tell a story. I'm running out of time. I've got stuff we want to do. I want to tell a story about, I think I've shared it here before, but let me tell it again. In Oxford, we ran these courses for healing. And people would come along. We would kind of teach on things like this. And if something spoke to them, then we would have small groups afterwards and we would pray. And there was this one guy, let's call him Samuel. And Samuel came. And Samuel's story was this. He was a Christian at a very big church in Oxford. Happy Clappy Church, very successful. And his weekends looked like this. Friday night, club, find a girl, take girl home, do the wild thing. Saturday night, hook up with the girl again, go to another club, go home, do it again. Sunday morning, dump girl. Sunday afternoon, come to church, mea culpa, I confess. Into next week, next Friday, same thing again. The man was in bondage. The man was in bondage. However much he wanted to stop doing this, he was almost driven to it. So one night after we'd taught, we were in the small group and he said, I want to talk, I want to share my story. And he told this. And then we started praying for him. And we just said, God, will you show us the truth? Samuel has confessed this now. Will you show us the truth of what's going on? And as we prayed for him, I got this very weird picture. And I apologize for this. It's kind of certificate 12, really. I had a picture of his parents. Having sex. And I thought, it's a bit bizarre. Let's just file that away in the thing. But nobody else was sharing anything. So I said to the guy, I've got this picture. Does it make any sense to you? And he said, yes. When I was 10 years old, my mum sat me down and said that I was a mistake, a complete accident, that they hadn't planned me, and that they weren't planning to have kids. So basically, when he was 10 years old, this man, his parents had sat him down and said, we didn't really want you. Do you think possibly that might have affected him? And we started praying again, and we prayed for him, and we prayed that God would come into his moment of conception and bring healing to the womb. Because it was suddenly very clear to him that he was going looking for love. That was what he was doing every week. He was looking for the love that he didn't have, that he felt his parents didn't have for him. So we prayed for him. We asked for God to come into his moment of conception to bring healing, to break the bond there that was over him. And there was lots of tears, lots of snot. And he walked out. The next week he came in, and let me tell you, he was a different man. I have never seen a transformation like this. All the weeks before he'd come in sort of slightly down, he was looking up, he was radiant, he was alive. We asked him how his weekend was. He said, just hadn't been a problem. And you know what, he hadn't had a problem weekend from that day onwards. And he went on to go work at a big Christian centre, and there he met his wife and got married. And it's just a wonderful story of God breaking the chains. And it's a story that can be any one of our stories in any one of our situations. But what we need to do is to let God do it. We need to know the truth. We need to name the truth and let the truth set us free.